Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth and Movies. I'm Leila Latif.
I'm Charles Bromesco.
And I'm Anna Bogusko.
On the show this week, family-friendly horrors await those who step into the haunted mansion, and I spoke to its charming director, Justin Simeon. A prince falls in love with the son of a president in red, white, and royal blue. And on Film Club, we revisit the old dark house. All coming up on Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. So, I mean, in our pre-recording chat, we were talking about this, like, cursed timeline. But it's very nice to have two of the pod's favourites back on, at least. And Anna, at least you're bringing us some good news about what's happening up in Scotland in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, there's a film festival, I hear. There's also some other kind of activity, maybe some fringe activity, maybe some book stuff going on. I think Edinburgh is, well, it's a privilege to be able to go there at any point in the month of August, because it is just buzzing in every single possible sense. And one of my jobs is I work as a programmer for the Edinburgh International Film Festival, which has been resurrected this year with an All Killer No Filler program. So I'm excited to go up in a week, I believe, at the time of this recording, and show people some great stuff. I'm actually genuinely really, really proud of the stuff that we've managed to pull together in a record time and with almost no resource. There's some of my favorite films that I've seen at international festivals this year, like Orlando, My Political Biography, and the Brazilian home invasion horror property. We're screening that. And one of the things I'd also love to highlight is the sidebar of talks that I've put together with kind of people from across Fringe, the book festival, and some of the filmmakers that are screening their films at our festival too. So they'll be all taking part in these sort of wide-ranging conversations from Sunday till Tuesday. So yeah, it's going to be a great time. Edinburgh is always a fun time in August, but I think this year in particular, everyone is kind of very enthusiastic and really supportive. So everyone just stop going to pubs and go to the movies and in Edinburgh.
I am so excited to do my first Edinburgh Film Festival. I used to go and do the Fringe all the time when I was a younger person, but like, yeah, that's pretty hardcore because you've got to keep going till like 4 a.m. to just see like increasingly drunk stand-up comedians and then wake up at like 7 a.m. for some weird experimental puppet show. But it's the best.
I'd like to go to this. I wish it wasn't so far away. I'm here in the States, and that I love going to odd performances at odd hours. That sounds like something I would enjoy.
Well, I mean, it's thanks to Anna and the rest of the team, it's going to keep going. So we look like we might lose it for a second, but it's back and it's here to stay.
Back and better than ever.
But Charles, the bearer of bad news. So we've had like, I suppose first, we both have this like rather personally painful thing because we both used to write for the AV Club and we stopped when they kind of changed hands and they kind of retooled what it was going to be. But yeah, dark news from that publication, eh?
Yeah, this week, for those of you who are not plugged into the world of digital media, because I assume you have healthy lives, the publication AV Club, which was really passionate work of a lot of independent critics in Chicago many, many years ago, got bought out by corporate interests and then sold to a venture, what you call it, venture capitalism? What are these things called? Stupid companies that always buy up things and destroy them.
I don't know what it is, and I refuse to learn at this point, but yes, venture capitalism, sure.
Yeah. A point being is that, you know, the whole thing has kind of gone down the tubes and they started running articles, although I hesitate to even call them articles because they're just collections of factual sentences written by AI, which is just mm-hmm. the worst thing you could possibly do. And it's very heartbreaking to see that happen at a publication that really used to epitomize everything I liked about culture writing. It was funny and irreverent and curious and altogether very human. There was a lot of personality in that website and now it is absent, which makes me very sad. It's like you had a great love in your life and then you run into them and they've just, you know, totally degraded themselves. What would be a comparison about that? Have you ever seen The Butterfly Effect starring Ashton Kutcher?
Yes, I have.
More than once.
Yeah, well, you remember, so he is in love with what's her name and then he like makes one wrong decision and then they flash forward to the future and she's addicted to crack.
Yeah, Amy Smart's character.
Amy Smart. It's exactly like that. It's an Amy Smart butterfly mm-hmm. effect situation. Classic.
Well, I feel like it's kind of a Warner Brothers situation where it's like, it feels like the people that took over this thing that used to be run and edited by people that really, really cared about movies and culture and cared about writing and like the whole art form of it. And then it got taken over by people that just couldn't care less about that. Like, I don't believe that the people in charge of Warner Brothers at the moment care that much about films because they're still like publishing, like, look how much money we saved by not paying anyone or making movies.
I'm sorry. The term I was trying to remember before is private equity firms, not venture capital firms, private equity firms who are, they are businesses where their whole job is to purchase companies and make them as profitable as possible and then sell them for, you know, a profit that they keep for themselves. And if, you know, you've ever read a newspaper or any sort of journalism or critical writing, you understand that its main function is not to generate money. And so that if that is the main imperative, then you start making all these really ugly decisions about how one of these publications should be run. And yeah, you've seen that happening in all sorts of different fields as well. You mentioned Warner Brothers. Same thing just happened. A very important American publishing house called Simon & Schuster was purchased by a private equity firm just this week. And soon they're going to start cranking out garbage, I assume. Very, very heartrending stuff to watch happen.
Yeah. Not to kind of make an awkward segue, but I mean, the other wild thing that's happened that you've been tangentially involved with is the amount of money that this QAnon movie has made. What's it called again? Something of Freedom?
It's just Sound of Freedom. I don't think there is a "the." I think it's a Facebook situation. It's The Sound of Freedom. No, it's just Sound of Freedom. For those of you who, again, have remained insulated from this information because you value yourself and your mental health.
I am one of those people and I can't wait to hear about this.
Well, this is what's really good. You know, I feel like I'm talking to an abstract listener in some cases, but actually I get to look at your face when I say all of the things I'm about to say.
So you can see my soul exit my body as you describe
like
this.
The light behind your eyes is going to dim ever so slightly. But yeah, this movie, which is in and of itself not all that scandalizing, it is a sort of Taken type action picture about this guy who's former military and he wants to liberate these abducted children who have been trafficked to Colombia to be sex slaves, I believe, which is definitely the worst kind of sex. Maybe, yeah, really, really bad. Terrible stuff. And in this movie, yeah, this guy who's a real fellow, Tim Ballard, he took it upon himself to liberate these children from the clutches of, not Bill Camp helps him. The important part is because this is a movie that kind of hinges on the idea that sinister child trafficking operations are everywhere, the conspiracy community of QAnon has kind of latched onto it as, you know, like, oh, finally, a bolt of truth has hit the film industry. And soon all of the many pedophiles hiding in Hollywood will be running scared. And it would be easy enough to ignore if not for the fact that it's made upwards of $100 million. I think it's finally crossed that mark, which is
certainly a lot of money. I believe it's made more than Mission Impossible.
In total? That's humiliating for Mission Impossible, if that's true.
No, surely that's not possible.
That can't be true. But although, I mean, so my point being is that this is not real money. I mean, it is, the money itself is real, but the way that this film has earned money is not real. When you go to see the movie, at the end, over the credits, you see the lead actor, Jim Caviezel, who is one of these QAnon guys who's talking about selling barrels of adrenochrome for 100 times as much as a barrel of crude oil goes. He appears at the end of the film to tell you about this pay it forward ticketing program where you can go onto a website and with just one or two clicks, you can buy as many tickets as you possibly want. And then other people can claim those and go see the movie. Or they can also not claim them and not see the movie, but those ticket sales still count, even though no human being is actually attending them. And so the, you know, stats for this movie have been juiced, as we like to say. I remember when I went to go see it, dutifully, right as the credits rolled, the person next to me bought $75 worth of movie tickets for the movie they just saw. And I was watching this happen, and I was like, well, this is a con in you know, the strictest sense. You see this a lot with evangelical books. When they want to be pushed to the top of the bestseller list, they rally their followings and are like, remember, buy 5 of these books or buy 10 of these books so that the mainstream, the cultural mainstream, has to recognize our weird thing. And that has happened again here. And so, yeah, I wrote about this movie at the time of its release, and then I got harassed in really precise and aggressive ways by literally thousands of people. It sounds like I'm exaggerating when I say that, but I think the total number of replies was like 3,500 or so. And so that was not the most fun week, but everyone moved on pretty quickly. These people have a way of, you know, they get tired of stuff quickly and they look for something else to get worked up about.
I mean, I'm all up for innovation and film exhibition, but this seems a straight up con.
Yeah, I mean, it absolutely is. It is just kind of the giving of money to a movie. It's not a traditional ticket sale that's in purchase and all. The funniest part is that because people are buying these movie tickets and no one's actually claiming them or going, you have the loyalists to this movie attending screenings and being like, pretty suspicious. This sold out screening of Sound of Freedom only had 4 people sitting in it. What's going on? What aren't they telling us?
I love it.
And I'm like, no,
it's
you
like
did
a self-fulfilling
that.
Conspiracy.
Well, that's the best part of QAnon, is that it's self-perpetuating. It's a very dark glimpse into the heart of American wing nuttery, is how I would put it.
And, you know, and the insistence that kind of white people in suburbia have to feel that they are the most endangered people on the planet.
That's the craziest part. Yeah, of course. Where it's like the likelihood, number one, of being abducted is so slim. But the idea of this movie, which is a very potent fantasy, as you're saying, is that like you could be abducted at any time in any situation for no reason. So watch out.
Yeah. Okay. I will go with the fact that I was pretty close to the numbers. So it's only been released in America. I believe it is coming out in England, where I'm guessing I'm sure it will do absolutely fine. To date, 164 million. It has beaten Indiana Jones. It has beaten The Flash. It has beaten Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1 and Transformers Rise of the Beasts.
Wow.
That is a massive humiliation for both Indy and Tom Cruise.
And it's starring Jim Caviezel, who's best known as Mel Gibson's Jesus, and turns out a real kook.
That's right. Yeah, he's an odd fellow. There are really, really funny interviews with him. If you're the kind of person who can laugh at this instead of feeling despair, his interviews are very funny because he keeps an extremely straight face while just saying the most bonkers things you've ever heard in your life.
Oh, I can't wait for the inevitable Jim Caviezel conspiracy podcast to drop.
That, yeah, we'll spin this off and do that as its own freestanding thing.
We should move on to another film that is trying to be scary in a very different way. It's Haunted Mansion.
Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member. We receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to our Steady HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans. Now on to the movies.
Single mom Gabby hires a tour guide, a psychic, a priest, and a historian to help exorcise her newly bought mansion after discovering it is inhabited by ghosts. Before we get onto the movie, I spoke to director Justin Simien about directing the film. Yeah, so first, kind of bring it back to like the Haunted Mansion ride itself. I think that was the last one that Disney himself actually had some involvement in.
Right, that's right.
Do you kind of see it as kind of the end of an era in some ways?
I don't know if it's the end of an era. I don't know. I don't know enough about Disneyland history to say that for sure. But you definitely feel him all over that ride, and you definitely feel it is a theme park ride. It does a lot of things, but at the end of the day, the story is actually the most important thing he's trying to tell and involve the audience in. And I found that to be quite an inspiration on multiple occasions trying to make this movie.
Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite nods to it in the movie is the bit where the pictures get
Long. The stretching room. Yeah. That was important. It was, you know, there was a stretching room kind of like cameo scene, let's call it, in the script. But I felt like it needed to be a proper set piece, you know, because it is just one of the most indelibly iconic moments on that ride. And it feels like a set piece when you're on it. It's sort of like you're trapped in there. It kind of sets the tone for the ride. It is this sort of physical standing moment in an otherwise like motion ride, and I just felt like, boy, we should really figure out a way to adapt that to, you know, to a movie.
Yeah, I mean, it was really lovely to kind of see it in the film because it didn't feel like it was just fan service. Like that scene works even if you haven't been on the ride.
Yes, it's because, you know, we had to, one of the important sort of guiding factors is like, we want to obviously like put in as much reference as we can and pay reverence to the ride, but it has to tell the story. It has to be inherent in the story. And so whether or not we were trying to figure out how to adapt the Pepper's Ghost effect, which is very specifically this effect that you see a lot on the ride where something appears to be in front of you because it's being reflected on this pane of glass in another room, but it's actually over here somewhere. And that effect is really cool in person. In a movie, it's a little dinky, but we were like, how do we, there's something about mirrors and looking through the glass and reflections. And so we spent a lot of time trying to extrapolate that into like kind of part of the cinema language of this particular movie. But there always has to be a why, you know, why is it? And for the stretching room sequence, it was like, well, the stretching room has to sort of either get them to a goal or get them further away from a goal. And we sort of figured out a way for it to do both. and it was a lot of fun putting together.
I mean, like, it's a really fun movie, but like it is properly moments that are scary. It's really, really funny, but which you've done before with Bad Hair. But like, is it really challenging to also kind of bring in, it's got to be funny, scary, and family friendly?
I don't find these things a challenge just because I grew up on them. It's a challenge to make because you have to calm a lot of people down while it's happening. There's a lot of people, and there's a lot more people that you have to calm down on a studio movie than one has to calm down in an independent movie. But you have to calm people down there too. Like, trust me, these things really do go together because they go together so well in Little Shop of Horrors. Remember how great that is? And remember how great all of those Tim Burton movies are from the late 80s and everything. So you're constantly like spewing comps at people to calm them down. And then fingers crossed, hopefully you can actually pull the thing off that you're referencing. But to me, those elements really belong together. I don't know. I grew up with that. I watched Nightmare on Elm Street from a very young age. And the thing about those movies that, for better or worse, have sort of like imprinted themselves on my soul is that horror and comedy really can live side by side. They both depend upon surprising the audience and kind of like throwing you off balance. And there's something really cathartic about a good laugh, just like there is about a good scream or like a good cry. You know, studying in film school and studying theater, we were always taught like, hey, the thing about Shakespeare, right, is that like his comedies are very serious and his dramas are very funny. So to me, that's part of telling a story. But there, like I said, there's quite a few people that just sort of, it's going to be okay. The children are going to be okay. Let's go for the screams. Let's go for the horror, or let's really go for the laugh. And then we can always cut it out if it's too much. Yeah. You know, that's the hardest part is just.
When I was a kid, I mean, those are the kind of stories that I loved. I loved like Roald Dahl. I loved kind of, Little Shop of Horrors. And I always feel like kids are actually able to handle a lot more than like a lot of the stuff we make for them is.
I agree. One of my favorite animated shows is Adventure Time. And I started watching Adventure Time as a fully grown adult in my late 30s. And that is a show where every single episode is about death, almost without fail. And yet it's a kid's show. And why does that work? Because when you're a kid, you're already going through some really intense stuff. You know it when a story is gaslighting you a bit and being like, everything's rainbows and furry time and fire. Listen, I'm a black queer kid that grew up in the South. It didn't take me that many years on this earth to realize the world is a bit chaotic and that the adults who run it are absolutely insane. And that there are, you know, terrifying things that I'm going to encounter. What I want to know is that I'm going to make it through them and that I'm going to be able to retain my sense of humor and always have a family around me while I'm getting through that, whether that's a family I got to go out and find myself mm-hmm. or the one that I came with, even though they're getting on my nerves. And those movies helped me sort of endure sometimes pretty difficult childhood. And I think kids need that. I really do. And I think that they feel respected when they see something that doesn't pull punches. And certainly the adults taking them to go see the movie mm-hmm. Feel respected, too, I think. And that's always good.
It feels like you, this was Wunderkind and like success came so easily. But did you have like kind of people and films like in your kind of early life that kind of you see as being the person that's the things that kind of set you on this path?
Wow. I got to say, I was both lucky enough and tortured by the fact that I knew I wanted to be a filmmaker since I was a kid. Mm-hmm. Tortured because I had no idea how to get there. There was nobody in my family who was part of that business. That was not a viable career to anybody, you know, to my mother, to anybody in charge with raising and advising me as mm-hmm. a kid. And it took me quite a bit of time in Hollywood to get there. I worked in publicity for 10 years before I got my first break. But I knew since I was a kid, there was actually, appropriate enough, this is a Disney movie, I had this this thing called a movie viewer, like a Fisher-Price movie viewer, and it would like project stills from old Disney cartoons onto your wall. And I remember just obsessively staring at the glow of that image on the wall and mm-hmm. its ability to take me out of wherever I was into a completely fictional, fully formed, you know, space. And I just was always obsessed with that. And I kind of had to work out on my own by reading the credits that it was someone's job to sort of pick what you see in a movie or a TV show and what the actor should be doing. And when I realized that that person was called a director and people paid them to do that, you know, I as a kid, I never said I wanted to be a fireman. It was just, I don't know, I just always wanted to be a director.
I mean, do you see some of yourself in Chase Dillon's character? I mean, I loved him in The Underground Railroad. I was very excited to see him.
I see myself in so many of the characters. Mm-hmm. But yeah, my inner child is that kid who's different. And I'm going to get a little emotional. I didn't have a father, you know, growing up. And sort of escaped and made do with his action figures. I was that kid. Mm. And I also am the adult that Ben plays, who's a little snarky and has a limit with people and, you know, but is also kind of funny, but is sort of covering up a lot of deeper stuff, you know, going on. And the two of them making a connection, even though fictional in this story, was something that was like kind of happening for me psychologically underneath the surface. And even though it's a big tentpole and all these stuff and special effects and stretching room and all that kind, it's a really personal story for me. It really, really is.
I feel like for a lot of kids, like being able to kind of see that rather than that kind of cookie cutter suburban view of childhood is actually probably more important than they'll realize till they're a lot older.
Those are definitely the movies that have always stuck to the bones for me and that I can watch, like I said, over and over again and get something new out of. And again, yeah, you might not realize exactly what it's saying to you, but I definitely wanted to say something with the movie, something real, something that I needed to hear and feel.
Yeah, and you've got these like surprisingly heavy kind of themes of grief and stuff that, you know, I was kind of expecting to see like Lakeith and DeVito being like absolutely delightful together. Yes. And then I was like, oh my God, why am I being punched in the heart?
Yeah, I mean, that's why, you know, I mentioned, you know, losing my father as a kid and I had to deal with grief at a remarkably young age. I think a lot of kids do. And I was dealing with grief as an adult, not specifically from a specific loss. But when I read the screenplay, we were still going through COVID. My show was finally wrapping up at Netflix, and the industry had already begun this sort of massive change spiral that it's in right now. There were a lot of losses that I was figuring out how to navigate at that time and that I had to be strong through. Mm-hmm. And I thought, what a wonderful story to tell about somebody who is very strong, but finds a group of people where he can actually, like, open up and move through some dark feelings It actually ended up being the anecdote and the answer that I was looking for but didn't know it in movie form. And I don't know. I just those are the movies I think about and the kinds of movies I want to make.
I got to say, whenever I come into any horror type of film with black people in it, my first thought is Eddie Murphy in Delirious, which has aged like warm milk in many respects. But that whole thing about like, you're going to have to do extra work to convince me that these black people are going to stay in
your house. Yes. Well, ironically, Eddie Murphy is in the first Haunted Mansion. First of all, I got to say, this is like, you know how there's like sub-tweets? I sub-direct sometimes. There's other stuff going on in my movies, including this one, aside from the plot and aside from the story and all that. One of the things that I take a lot of delight in is that cinema really is founded on a lot of different stereotypes about black people. And one of them is that, you know, we just cannot handle ghosts, okay? and that we, you know, to hilarious quote-unquote effect and quite offensive effect to us nowadays, if you watch movies from like the 20s and 30s and 40s, you know, black people being scared of ghosts is like a very common trope. And so what I love so much that Eddie Murphy, who is kind of one of the first black comedic leading men who isn't apologizing for his existence on camera, those movies in the 80s, he is so much smarter and funnier than anybody in the film, white or black, and has absolutely no apologies for it, none given. And we love him for that self-confidence that he, you know, sort of is a part of turning that tide of like moving into a haunted mansion and braving the things that he finds there. I take a lot of pleasure in Lakeith being a version of that, someone who, you know, not only encounters things that scare him, but does so with a bravery and a sense of vulnerability that I think is still really uncommon for black men on screen. I get a little delight out of helping with that story a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, the two of you just seems like fated to be in some ways. But I'll leave you with, so post the kind of big giant blockbuster, big release movie, do you want to stay in that lane or do you kind of envision maybe like a returning to kind of smaller indie stuff?
You know, I don't really think about stories in terms of big or small. I know that I continue to want more space to tell personal stories of any size, and to tell them in my way. I become more and more convinced each time I do it, because I'm a collaborative guy, and if I move into a space that I've never been in before, like TV or, you know, studio temple making or indie film, I'm going to listen to what the people who have been there already tell me about what the process should be. But once I've done it once, then it's about me doing it my way. And I really look forward to that because I think most of the time I'm right about how I think a project should to fruition. And, you know, I got to say, we are doing this interview during a really tumultuous time in the industry. I think what's happening in terms of the labor movements, and I'm a part of two guilds, one that's on strike, one that has made a deal and sort of demands that its members continue their duties on films, the Directors Guild, thank you very much. But I am very much about this this moment in time. I think a lot of the changes that are being asked for are not only necessary, but just scratch the surface. And so I'm looking forward to picketing and taking some time off to just kind of cook as a writer and see what I want to do, you know, now that my development executives, you know, can't call me for, you know, a few months. Yeah, to be continued, how exactly I answer that question, but that's the goal.
Yeah, it does feel a bit like monkey paw answer to it. They're like, I really would like some time off.
Yeah, like a little bit. Way. I both want to keep working and I want to stop working for a contained period of time.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Yes. This is awesome. So that was director Justin Simien. Anna, did you come into this with like much love for this property, this Disneyland ride of the Haunted Mansion?
Well, to be honest, I might be the most outside of the target audience, which I presume are children and not film critics in their mid-30s. I went into Haunted Mansion kind of with no set expectations, really. I mean, there were whatever expectations there were, they were pretty low, but I have absolutely zero relationship with Haunted Mansion, the ride. I did not grow up in the US or the UK. I don't know if that ride even exists here at all, or the only Disneyland I've ever visited was in Paris, and I was too overexcited about meeting Minnie Mouse to even remember. I went into a fugue state and just remember the chocolate and meeting Minnie, and that is all. There's pictures.
That completely jars with like my expectations of you as a child. I'm always picturing Wednesday Addams not giving a crap about many and like running to the haunted stuff.
Two things can be two at once. I went through many, many phases. A lot of them overlapped. But I did love my local haunted mansion, right? Which I'm still genuinely a bit too terrified to revisit.
But this was not branded. This was just an independent.
It was not branded.
Okay.
It was an independent Barcelona-based
an indie haunted house.
And yeah, exactly. That is my vibe. I don't want to go to the corporate haunted mansion. I want to go to the independent haunted mansion. But yeah, so I came into it kind of fairly unaware of the, as far as I know, from several friends and from that video of Ryan Gosling also going to a fugue state over the possibility of making a haunted mansion movie. I do not recognize any of these characters. I don't know any of the lore. I had no expectations of who the characters might be. I genuinely had very little pre-awareness of it. I had a nice time. It's aggressively fine. There is nothing particularly special about it. I would want to hear how your kids reacted to it if they've seen it, Layla, because I imagine for kids, this might be an absolute joyride. I always enjoy seeing like Keith Stanfield. Genuinely, the man can make gold out of pieces of shit, which I imagine is what the script was. But he is so watchable and so damn charismatic. I ended up being just captivated by him, whatever nonsense he was doing on screen. The special effects are terribly goofy, but again, for kids, this might work. And all in all, I just thought it was deeply inoffensive. But then again, I'm entering a state of just such extreme disillusionment with how far the line between corporate marketing branding exercises and what we previously conceived of as cinema have overlapped and joined forces, that I'm genuinely just still trying to make sense of the ickiness that I feel of movies that I both enjoyed a lot, like Barbie, like Blackberry and whatnot, and movies that are just fundamentally so visibly exercises in branding extensions that I can only think in marketing speak when I'm seeing them, like this kind of.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty fair criticism. I kind of felt like there was like a bit of the movie that they cared about. Oh, like particularly maybe like Justin Simeon like put a lot of weight behind, and like I think like Lakeith had a lot of moments. I mean, just like the whole Owen Wilson doing his shtick thing is like extremely watchable. And then nonsense. And before I move on to you, Charles, I've got to ask you, Anna, about your number one nemesis in the world. What did you think of Jared Leto in this film?
I'm going to pivot this question to you, Layla Latif, and ask you, why do you insist on hurting me like this? What vendetta do you have that we end up always podcasting about my number one nemesis on this planet, in this realm, and in every single realm discovered and yet to be discovered? I purposefully ignored his presence in this film, and thankfully it's just voice. Which, fine, do whatever goofy shit you want to do, Mr. Leto. I just don't want to see your smug cult leader face on my screens. And thankfully, it's just all CGI.
I assume that would have been a nice twist for you because, like, you know, they announce in the opening credits Jared Leto as the Hatbox ghost, and then he's just not in it. It's great.
I immediately soured.
No, yeah, as a friend of mine pointed out, the scariest moment of the movie comes in so early at that point in the credits where they're like, guess what? Jared Leto is in this.
I mean, Charles, for you, I mean, it's clearly quite a cynical exercise. The product placement is like not trying to disguise itself. Did you manage to find any kind of artistic merits in it?
Yeah, I definitely, I feel for, you know, Justin, who I've enjoyed his films in the past. And I get the sense that making this, he was beholden to a lot of different, you know, corporate demands, because God, some of that product placement is very clumsy, very distracting. But no, I mean, it's, you know, these movies are supposed to be fun. And I think that is a useful subset of horror. We don't see too many horror movies that actively shoot for spooky over actually scary. And I think that that's, I like horror movies for kids. It reminds me of like Halloween, you know, plastic and rubber, foam, trick-or-treating, all these things. And I like that atmosphere for a movie. And I think that Haunted Mansion is best when it's kind of working that angle. Which is to say, like, every single scene with Tiffany Haddish. Owen Wilson is fun. Who else is fun?
Jamie Lee Curtis is fun as well.
Yeah, she's okay. that was very mean. No, I don't know. That was fine. Yeah, I mean, the production design, the mansion looks good. It's clear that the team who worked on that put some thought into it and drew from the ride, which I have very vague memories of going on as a child. However, I'll say this, and I feel almost guilty, but I had a great experience watching this movie However, very little of that had to do with the film itself. I've been so excited to share this story with you since I saw this movie last week. I went to the Alpine Cinema in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, to attend a 3:40 p.m. matinee on a weekday of The Haunted Mansion, which I thought would be a pretty chill time to go see a movie. Surprisingly full, which I realized is because kids get out of school at like 2 p.m. And so if you're a parent looking for something to do with your child, you can just bring them there. And I was like, sure, that's fine. I sit down relatively close to the front, a husband and wife and like their brood of five kids all kind of pile in the row directly behind me. And then I think there was another large group of a single mother with three kids. The kids behind me would not shut the hell up during the entire movie. They kept talking and talking and talking, and they would not stop talking. And the parents didn't really seem concerned about this. They weren't doing anything. And so the family a few rows back says, "Can you quiet your children?" And the woman's like, "They're fine. They're not causing a problem." And she's like, "We're at the movies and they won't stop talking. My kids are trying to watch this." And then the woman goes, "Why don't you mind your own business?" And then the other woman goes, "Why don't you mind your fucking mouth?" And then these two mothers start screaming and hurling obscenities at each other. One of them literally tells the other to suck my dick. And then the other goes, "I don't want to suck your dick." And I'm just cracking up from the screen. There are children everywhere hearing this. Like, staff at the theater has to be brought in to tell both women to either stop or leave. It's the funniest thing. And I enjoyed that part of the movie very much.
Wow. What moment in the movie did that happen?
Yeah, I wish I could tell you. It was definitely like, I would say almost exactly halfway into the middle type area when it was like, it had become clear that these kids were not going to stop talking. My other favorite thing was that, you know, the parents come in loaded with sodas and popcorns and everything. And after about 30 seconds, a kid just spills an entire large Coke directly onto the floor and starts freaking out. And the mom's like, "I'm not getting you another one." I hope Justin Simien enjoys knowing the really powerful reactive effects that his movie has had on its viewers. It's simple, you know. I would have enjoyed more of the fun stuff and less of the kind of weirdly grown-up somber stuff. Like, the fact that this movie is about grief and, like, missing your dead wife. Isn't this a movie for children?
I mean, it was for my children. My children, who I would add, have impeccable cinema etiquette and would never... I suppose I'd be the woman who was, like, starting the fight in that scenario. Because, like, yeah, that is my sacred space and my kids know it. And I will, I suppose, cut a bitch if needed. my daughter loved it. Like, and I think there is like a weird thing, and it's like something that recurs in like all the kind of classic Disney movies, is like kids do kind of get grief in a weird way. It's why like so many of them are about somebody's parent dying, because it's like emotional beats wise, they can just kind of get into it. So I like the big, sad Lakeith Stanfield eyes missing his dead wife, even though I would add that I think the reshoots of this were really pretty clear, not least because Chase Dillon grows a foot and his voice gets an octave lower.
Some of the ADR is really, really evident. Like, some of the product placement, you can see that once they had figured out who was going to be paying, that is when they recorded the dialogue. But the one line that I did laugh at a lot, and Lakeith delivers it really well, is when he's about to like go back into the haunted mansion for the climactic confrontation, and he puts the kid in the car and he says, "If I'm not back in 5 minutes, and I can't believe I'm going to say this, call the cops." And I was like, yeah, Lakeith, if you're going to say call the cops, you have to bring up that it's not the right thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I did laugh. I did laugh at like a couple of the Danny DeVito lines, particularly when he's kind of interrupting those like somber moments with like a moment of levity. Like, I wasn't not charmed by a lot of it. I mean, Anna, for you, like comedy-wise, did it work?
Well, I think the word you use is exactly the right one, because like Keith Stanfield, Tiffany Haddish in particular, are such skilled comic performers as well, that when Tiffany's on screen in particular, especially when she's sort of doubting her powers and not really performing to the most of her abilities, and sort of surly with her giant clip-on nails in the background, that's when I couldn't resist, and I did chuckle a bit. Whenever she's on screen, whenever Lakeith is on screen and allowed to sort of be grumpy and antisocial, not just earnest Lakeith, I found myself inevitably charmed by them.
Yeah, it's a testament to how far a movie can get just by collecting a handful of likable people and letting them be funny.
Exactly. And, you know, I'm always on board with what Jamie Lee Curtis is doing most of the time. You know, she's performing to a type. And I mean, Owen Wilson, we know exactly the shtick that he will always deliver, and he delivers it. So if you're into that kind of thing, it's going to work for you. If you're not, it's going to be an irritant.
But yeah, I think I watched it once for the junket because I was talking to Justin, and then I watched it again with my daughter at the kind of big splashy multimedia thing. And I did watch it just kind of like do its job, where I'm just like, I want my kids to grow up and watch a ton of horror movies with me. And like, this is her gateway drug. It's working. She loved it. Like, she liked it being spooky and scary, but it wasn't like too intense that it actually put her off.
The point, and sometimes I feel kind of at odds when I'm tasked with reviewing a film that is so clearly made for children or even for kind of preteens or, you know, young teenagers. I'm not the right person. I don't have those eyes and I'm not the parent. So I can't even think of, you know, watching a movie that I would like to show my kids. So I think, you know, your daughter is probably a better judge of this film than either of us is, of whether this film actually accomplishes the task that was set up for it.
I'm very excited. Next up is going to be Little Shop of Horrors. That was my gateway drug.
The old Roger Corman one or the musical?
The musical, the one with the trio singing everything, the one with Steve Martin as the dentist. That's what I think that's going to really solidify some like horror nerdery in her.
It's a good influence on a child. I love that movie.
Yeah. So I don't know what you think, Charles. I mean, when something is so clearly like product, and we've kind of been talking so much about how like, you know, the kind of need for the almighty dollar really like squeezes the artistry out of something. Like, do you think that this managed to kind of break free at all of like those constraints?
I don't know. I can't decide whether to give in to my lenient side or my cynical side. I didn't get too much from this movie, and it felt to me like, having seen Justin Simien's past work, he's very much a filmmaker of ideas, as they like to say. He's a guy who has a lot of on his mind, in particular about race, and that is manifest in this movie really only insofar as it is about Lakeith Stanfield, and I guess Rosario Dawson is the mom, right? Is that the case?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the case.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's harmless relative to some other kids' movies I've seen in recent years. But I think if I had a child of my own, God, what a thought, I would probably pick a different thing to watch with them, is how I will put this.
Very diplomatic. Anna, do you want to go first with some scores on this in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
I'm going to say anticipation one, mainly because I had no expectations, very, very slight ones. Enjoyment three, in retrospect two.
Yeah, that seems fair. I mean, it's fine. It's fine. It's like stuff that like Justin Simien does like a lot with. But overall, it's fine. Charles?
I would say anticipation, probably three. You know, I mentioned before, I enjoy that kind of kid-geared form of horror, which I think is fun and useful. Enjoyment, if I was to relegate that strictly to the text of the film, I would say two. If I said the experience overall, six. And then if in retrospect, I would say probably two.
Well, I think that's higher than you gave it the last time we were all united for Bullet Train. So things are looking up.
I hated Bullet Train way more than this movie. Justin, if you're listening to me, you made a much better film than Bullet Train.
But next up, it's Red, White, and Royal Blue.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Alex is the son of the first female president of the United States, who is running for re-election. During a royal wedding, he has a physical altercation with Henry, a British prince. Alex and Henry must then pretend to be friends with each other to prevent it from becoming a full-blown diplomatic crisis, and romance blossoms.
I'm pretty sure they both get fully blown in the course of this diplomatic crisis, don't they?
Yeah, I really walked into that one with this summary.
And with that, No,
Charles, why is Uma Thurman in this?
She can't possibly need the money, right? I guess if you're Uma Thurman and you're like, you get to be the first lady president in this movie and you get to do a Bill Clinton impression the whole time, I suppose I would probably say yes to that. Even though, like, the vibe of those scenes in that Oval Office set is... I said this when I was watching it. I was like, it feels like this should be a porno where the president of the United States is a very well-endowed woman. Like, that is the quality of the production design in that set. And then also the way she cradles her biological son is, like, I don't know, kind of weirdly intimate, right? That one scene when he's like, Mom, it's I'm gay. Insane. And it really looks like they're going to kiss for a moment.
No. And then she says, like, really explicit stuff to him about what he might be up to. And it's just, it doesn't help with those, like, Oedipal charges.
Not beating the Oedipal allegations. No. Yeah. So what's my big take on this movie, which is just so much going on here, much to discuss. This, we could do a whole podcast about this one. But the thing that struck me most and that I kind of wanted to start with is that this is a romance between two men, as is clear. And yet it does not feel in any meaningful respect like a gay movie. It is very, very clear that this was written by a heterosexual woman for other heterosexual women. It kind of reminds me of, like, when guys like to fantasize about two girls kissing. I'm like, it's kind of nice that women also have their own equally objectifying version of that.
Yay, equality!
Yeah, in a sense.
Oh, God. I mean, last week when we were talking about Meg 2, I said that, like, I'd gotten to this point where I just know too much about submersibles and sharks to, like, actually be able to kind of accept that film on this terms. After that Biden election, where I spent like a week, 24 hours a day watching that guy with a map talking about the counties in Georgia on CNN, I know too much about the Electoral College to be able to buy this movie's tactics.
I think if we're going to start getting into the nitty gritty of what is or is not plausible, the idea that a Texan congresswoman who did not win her own state could somehow become president of the United States strains credibility to me. I mean, that's a Trump situation. Everyone in New York hated him and no one voted for him, but he still won. I don't know. Maybe I'm being ungenerous to the writers of Red, White, and Royal Blue. It was definitely written by an American woman, correct? This is
the book that it's based on was written by an American woman, yes. Apparently, while she was reading a biography of Hillary Clinton and watching something to do with the royal family and wondered what it is.
And the royal family.
To echo Charles's previous point, I don't think anyone involved with writing the original novel or making this movie or performing in it has ever watched any gay porn, because none of these, there is so little, just non-existent sexual tension between any of these characters. The dialogue literally is, I have not read the novel, I'm afraid, on which Red, White, and Royal Blue is based. It's on my to-be-read pile. I've honestly just hearing you debate the logistics and the veracity of how Uma Thurman became the first female president of the United States in this, I'm told, motion picture. I think you've just done more discussing about the practicalities of American politics than anyone involved in this film and or novel have ever done in their life. So I don't believe the author of this book ever finished that biography of Hillary Clinton, because she should know better, having read maybe just one article about how the American electoral system works. I genuinely despair. I don't think I have a single point to make about this film, because it fueled a depressive episode in me that I really wanted to keep at bay. It made me consider blocking every single one of you and never talking to you again for making me watch this movie, which, to be honest, would be appropriate.
That's fair. That's entirely fair. I like this mostly in that it's nice that this is a transatlantic podcast we're doing today, that we have Americans and friends in the UK exchanging thoughts, because I think that at its heart, more so than the relationship between these two men, this is about what if the relationship between the US and the UK took on romantic terms. And I'd like to pose a question to the both of you. Do you think it is right and accurate that the UK would be bottoming for the US?
Yes, I think that's been the case for quite some time. I think Tony Blair actually kind of really solidified that under George W. Bush.
I believe that's what they call the special relationship, isn't it?
It was a very special relationship. So the sex scenes are kind of where the movie really, really falls apart, because you can tell throughout the movie in less overt ways that like these people really thought they did something, but they were like, this is about like gay pride and it's about the, you know, coming out. And the whole thing is that these two guys, because they're in a very prominent public position, they have to be closeted and they have to come out. But even though they're trying to engage with these very real and, you know, difficult ideas that are built into the question of identity and sexual orientation, their execution is just so basic and simple. You can tell that there's no interiority to these experiences. And we especially see that in the sex, where the shot is from basically the torso up, which means that we can see Mr. Fancy Prince's legs hitched up as he's taking it from our American friend. And just the geometry of that scene, while not strictly inaccurate, is just like so inert and antiseptic. And just, it does not seem like sex between two men in the slightest.
Yeah, not since Tommy Wiseau's The Room have I seen two people that don't seem to know the very basics
of how things work and what's going on.
Yeah, what's enjoyable. Hannah, I mean, like, one of the things that you texted me is the same experience that I had, where you keep trying to adjust the picture settings.
Thank you.
Explain.
This is true. I did, in fact, text you this, because when I put my screener on and I put it on my wonderful giant television, I thought that there was something wrong with my beautiful giant TV, because I kept trying to adjust the picture settings, because it looked all washed out, like someone had been playing, like some teenager had put the Instagram filter on maximum on this entire movie. And turns out there was nothing wrong with my beautiful, flawless television. I just keep complimenting it because it's the only good thing about the experience of watching this film. And it was just done in this antiseptic, filtery kind of way, where, frankly, is that even the worst thing about this movie? No, but it did just kind of add annoyance to the sense of despair that I felt watching it. And also, if I may just correct myself, I've been doing a bit of fact checking on myself. And in fact, the author of the novel that this is based on is not a woman, is a non-binary author, and they are also queer, which, frankly, disappoints me even more.
Yeah. No, that palette was really giving Instagram's lock. I mean, it's a very, very strange film, because it kind of asks us to believe that there are like insurmountable odds against these two, and there simply aren't. And also, they get together real quick, which takes a lot of the tension and stakes out of it. Like, most of it, this movie is people having pleasant conversations.
Yes. It's it's supposed to be soothing in that way. The only conflict is with King Stephen Fry, which, like, of all the people I feel bad for getting roped into this, he might be the one I feel the most bad for. But the whole thing where he's just like, please, it would embarrass the crown if people knew that you were gay. I'm like, wasn't Prince Andrew a pedophile? I feel like that ship has sailed. He was a nonce. Once you've got a nonce in the family, I think normal, healthy, handsome gay guy is not nearly the embarrassment that you might worry about.
And on the BBC, it just kind of, it kind of asks us to forget like the past decade of like royal events.
Yeah.
Not that that's something that I particularly care about, but it's like as if anyone would give a crap. And then these characters are generally in this film being like, what is it that royalty really significantly contributes to the common man?
Well, nothing, right? That's the whole thing of them.
I think the other thing that, if this is a movie that supposedly puts us in the a moment of two of the most privileged young people on the entire planet, why does it look so trashy? As in, why does everyone dress so cheaply? Why do the interiors look so basic? Why is everything from H&M Home? And I'm not dissing H&M Home. I quite like that. But that is not the privilege porn that I'm... That's not what I go for when I'm looking to see a fictionalized erotica about the lifestyles of the rich and the richer.
Yeah. Why does the prince's one best friend, a black man in a terrible peroxide blonde wig? And yeah.
So there are two things that I wanted to ask if they kind of scan for a UK audience, which is that... Layla, you had said you'd watched American Politics, but are either of you familiar with like who Rachel Maddow is and what she signifies as a cultural figure?
Yes, but yes. I'm perpetually online.
Okay, well, that's fair then. Yeah, so I mean, her presence in this is also a very funny like kind of sop to the gaze where they're like, look, I know who you like. It's Rachel Maddow. It's your friend Rachel Maddow. But more to the point, I wanted to ask, because I think what kind of almost ties all this together is, are you familiar with Hallmark original movies in the UK? Do you have those?
Yes.
So yep. That is the vibe that I was really feeling here, where it is like everything is unnaturally bright and no one is good at acting. And even though they're all about like luxury, these are all about escapism and about like, what if my life is so fabulous and easy? They don't have the money to follow through on that idea. And so, yeah, as you said, the results are really dissonant and kind of very community theater in their own way.
Yeah, but I just feel like when I watch a Hallmark movie, it's more into kind of being like bright and silly, and we don't have to talk to see Uma Thurman talking about like bottoming to her son, and like there's like actual color. It's not like dark and dingy and brown and 2 hours long for no apparent reason.
Yeah, how did that movie end up being 2 hours? Who let that happen?
And they, you know, and this isn't a tiny movie. Like, this was doing big premieres at the IMAX, I believe, and which seems crazy because, like, Oppenheimer, I thought, took over all of those.
What I had heard, that Paul Ridd saw it on a gigantic movie screen, which is what I would imagine a very upsetting way to take in this film.
That sounds disgusting to me as a cinematic experience.
The other thing, I love how tidily this movie is tied up. The fact that the whole dramatic stakes hinge on their being in the closet and being able to come out. And just as soon as King Stephen Fry is done yelling at them to remain closeted, they just remember that being gay is acceptable in the present day. It's like in Popstar when he makes the song about legalizing gay marriage, even though gay marriage is already legal. It's very, very easily resolved everything.
Yeah, I do feel like this would have been allyship in like 1999, to be fair.
Yeah, that is about as far back as you'd have to go for this to seem progressive.
Anna, I don't want to make you feel more depressed given that we made you watch this.
And Gran Turismo.
Yeah, that it. Okay, yes. So listeners, we were going to do Gran Turismo this week, and I would just say they pushed the date.
They did. This is true.
We
this
didn't.
Is not your ongoing vendetta against me, my love for cinema. Any final thoughts? Watch anything else. Just literally any other movie, any other movie that exists on the same streaming service and VHS, Blu-ray. Go outside. Just look at a tree. Maybe look at a wall. That would be more better framed and better lit than this.
So I'm excited to hear, what are your scores in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
I was going to make a minus rating, but let's just stick to reality. 0, 0, 0 across the board. Thank you very much.
Charles, any improvement on 0?
I would say, and I've lobbied Little White Lies to add half marking. So I would say 0.5 anticipation, 5 level of enjoyment, and then 0.5 in retrospect, back down to 0.5. I had a scream. I was under the influence of controlled substances at the time, which is probably the best way to take in this motion picture. But yeah, that's my disclaimer, but it is the truth.
But I feel like that's cheating, because then you're reviewing the controlled substances.
Well, I'm reviewing my experience of the film, aren't I? And that is subject to so many different factors. You know, over the course of a day, if I'm having a bad day and I go to see a movie, that also has its own effect on how we receive it. I think there are many different factors to consider.
That's fair enough. Yeah, I'm going to join Anna and 0s across the board. I saw no merit to any of this, and I wish I hadn't seen it.
I feel like if you want to see two hairless men kissing each other, there are much more expedient ways to go about doing that. We have a whole internet that's just full of that. Oh, and I guess against my will, I was made aware of this term from the manga or anime community or whatever, which is called fujoshi, which is a word for a heterosexual woman who is obsessed with love between men, two men being in love. So I guess this is like the white American equivalent of that, if that's useful for anybody.
I mean, maybe for some search terms for people, that might be
useful. Yeah. You're going to find some cool subreddits off of that.
But yeah, next up, it's Film Club, which far and away the highlight of my week. The old dark house is set in interwar Wales, and the film follows five travellers who seek shelter from a violent storm in the decaying country house of the eccentric femme family. So, like, Anna, safe to say this is the best movie we watched this week? I mean, this didn't do that well upon its release, but it's great.
It's a classic. It's a James Whale-directed, spooky, old, creaky house classic. I had seen this film before. There was a re-release in the UK a handful of years ago, so I actually got to experience it for the first time on the big screen in a new restoration. It is by a mile, the best film we're going to talk about this week. And it is, I believe, even though it's been sort of reclaimed, restored, re-released across the land several times over and is regularly kind of charted on the specialist horror polls about classic horror films and the like, I think it's not as well known as James Whale's other horror films, most notably, of course, the original Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein. And it so deserves to be discovered by people, especially by horror fans who have seen everything that maybe, you know, Blumhouse and James Wan have put out over the last 20 years, but want to brush up on some old classics. It's one of those films where it might not be surprising, or it's definitely not scary. It's in the spooky variety, like you were talking about earlier, Charles. But it is so lovely to go back to a film that is so foundational, that sets up so many of the tropes and the cinematic conventions that we've become so used to and that have been transformed and that have been made elastic over decades of the genre shifting and reframing and updating itself. But it's never a chore to revisit Old Dark House.
Charles, was this a revisit for you, or was this a
It had been a good long while, but I had seen it before, just as wonderful as I had remembered. And I'm glad that, you know, Anna brought up Frankenstein, which is clearly the better known of his works. And I was thinking about why that is, because they're both, you know, I would say on a level with each other as far as quality goes. And I thought about how gothic horror, which really kind of begins here in terms of cinema with this movie, has always been a very difficult sell, because it's all about atmosphere. Like, stuff doesn't jump out at you. There's no monster that you can sell toys of or whatever. It's really just about just horrible vibes getting under your skin. And we see that same difficulty with so many movies in the present day. Like, they had no idea how to market Crimson Peak for that same reason. The Little Stranger with Donald Gleason. All of these movies, which are so reliant on mood and just kind of the chill in the air, they played their pleasures a little close to the vest. But then once you actually sit down and really watch it and get inside of it, it's like, ooh, I love it. I thought it was kind of scary, actually. I think the Pyro Brother, kept in the locked room, that, you know, gives me the willies. So yeah, I love this film a lot. And I think the really funny thing is, although it's obviously linked to Haunted Mansion, I also think it makes a pretty good pairing with Red, White, and Royal Blue, because, you know, James Whale, who was a real life gay man, his work has been read as queer allegory, I think, by kind of generations of scholars now. And we see a lot of that same, you know, themes of repression, about this idea of being closeted, about having to hide, you know, your own id or parts of yourself in different chambers of your psychology, like the rooms of the house, which is such a cool way to look at this movie. And for him, a really intelligent way to address personal matters at a time when they, you know, you couldn't do that explicitly.
Yeah. I mean, imagine a time where movies had allegories. we were so young then. And obviously Boris Karloff, I mean, like, kind of got, there's such a fixed picture of him in the culture because of this iconic role of Frankenstein. I mean, like, for you, seeing him doing something quite different as Morgan, like, was that an exciting element?
It's always a joy to see Karloff on screen, isn't it? Outside of Frankenstein and all kind of the classic universal horror roles that he played, there is, I think, the thing that most people remember so fondly about him is his physicality and this immense presence that he brings, no matter what the role. And as Morgan obviously, he also has the makeup on, but there's a recognizable element to him, just the sheer size of him. He was a very large, tall man. The jawline, the nose, you know, once he's on screen, even though he's under heavy, heavy makeup, you know exactly who that is. And it always, at least for me, as a fan of both Lugosi and Karloff, whenever either one of them is on screen, I just get, I'm just tickle pink. I love seeing them on screen. And I love this particular kind of wordless, silent presence that they bring, and how they imbue characters that are, you know, you're not going here for character depth to these kind of movies. It's not this one in particular, because it's an ensemble chamber piece. You're not, everyone plays into a particular characteristic, almost kind of character. But he in particular is always a standout.
I mean, one of my favorite things that has ever happened in cinema history is that, like, in later life, when Bela Lugosi fell on hard times, it was Boris Karloff that came to his aid and made sure that he was okay. I mean, it just, like, breaks my heart looking at him on screen, because I think that's why he's so good in this and why he's so good in Frankenstein, is there's just a kind of innate goodness. There's a heart to him that you can't get away from.
It's they did him dirty in the Ed Wood movie that Tim Burton did, where they portray Bela Lugosi as being very bitter against Boris Karloff. I think he says Boris Karloff can eat my shit in that movie, but they were very close to one another. And I think you see kind of that love of the game in this movie, where it is made by and also performed by people who understand the tone of this so well. And the whole movie is tone, but it's about that kind of archness, that kind of heightened atmosphere that, I don't know, that kind of thing just really works for me.
I mean, before we move on to our final thing, Anna, I mean, we could do a whole hour on how just delightful this is, but like, any final thoughts on the Old Dark House, Anna?
Nothing particularly new to add outside of discover it if you haven't yet. And like Charles said, kind of it is about the vibes and the atmosphere of a creaky Gothic mansion. So it's always a joy to rediscover it or discover it anew if someone hadn't seen it before. I think it's also fairly accessible for both horror fans and non-genre fans alike.
I would just ask if either of you seen the 1960s remake? I haven't,
but I'm extremely curious to. Yeah, I read about this when I was researching, and that sounds so cool. I would love to, and especially I've lately, I guess this would be the other side of this, but I've been watching a lot of remakes of the Hammer movies. In the 2000s, there was Castle Films, which was a small imprint that redid House on Haunted Hill, Ghost Ship, a lot of the good old ones. And so I feel like that would keep that streak going if I was to see the remake of the James Whale one.
Well, there is that one good scene at the beginning of Ghost Ship.
Yes, so. Indeed.
It wasn't, it's, you know, not entirely devoid of merits. But yes, I mean, before seeking out Ghost Ship, strongly recommend you seek out the Old Dark House first. And there is a very good restoration available, so you do get to be able to kind of see it in all of its glory. So to finish things off, Anna, what is your recommendation for people to seek out if they don't want to watch a movie?
Well, mine is going to be a book, and I believe it's out already. It's Silver Nitrate, which is a horror novel, but it's set in the 90s in the Mexican film industry, and it has to do with a forgotten filmmaker and a cursed movie and occultism. It's a really fun read for anyone who's into the Old Dark House, really. And it's by Silvia Moreno García, I think.
So is this kind of like more on the horror side, or is this kind of in the more spooky vein of the movies that we've been talking about this week?
I'm going to say it's more in the spooky vein. Perhaps I'm a bit more hardened, but I think my barometer for getting scared by books has been pretty high ever since I was a kid. But this one is more in the spooky realm, especially if you're interested in older movies and are of the Nitrate Brigade or the #35mm Brigade on film Twitter, then this might be enjoyable.
I do love a scary book. I mean, I think the only one that like actually fully got me though is when I read Turn of the Screw for the first time. And at one point I threw that book across the room because I was so scared. But, you know, the bar is high, and like a recommendation from yourself, Anna, is high praise indeed. So yes, consider that ordered from my local independent bookshop. Definitely not taking a trip up the Amazon. I have ethics. Charles, what about you?
My recommendation is from cinema's little sibling television. I have recently been enjoying the outstanding HBO series. I don't know if it's available in the UK. I don't know if it's on Sky like all the other HBO things, but How To with John Wilson, it's called, which is, it's a sort of creative documentary series about this fellow who teaches you ostensibly how to do simple things like have small talk with a stranger or find a parking spot. And his sort of filmed essays always spin out into meditations on isolation, mortality, the strictures of society. It's really, really funny. It's really clever. I've never seen someone approach documentary cinema this way before, except maybe Ross McElwee a little bit. But it's terrific. And what's more, and especially, you know, this being a UK podcast, it's the best TV show about New York there is. It is about my New York, which is a New York of street level weirdos. It's not in the penthouses of Succession. It's in the bodegas, and it's in the Armenian restaurants, and it's on the sidewalks. And just thinking about it makes me emotional. I love the city of New York so much. And I think that city makes it really clear why, which is that if you just go out and take a walk for a half hour, you will see at least 3 to 5 astonishing things just happening all over. It's a really good show.
Not least if you wander into a cinema and see two mothers like
ready to fight each other. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. No, I've done a quick Google. How To with John Wilson is actually in the UK available on multiple platforms. It's great. Like,
terrific.
Yeah. We don't have to do the whole thing where you sign up to a million subscription services and then discover that you have to buy everything on iTunes anyhow. Very good news. That is, how many seasons are there of this show? Because I'm kind of seeing, I'm feeling a binge watch coming.
Yeah, the third and final season is currently running. I believe the third of the 6 episodes airs on Friday, the day that this podcast will be out.
Well, thank you very much. That sounds wonderful and enriching. If you've got thoughts on these films, email truthandmovies@tco.london or tweet us at LWLies. Next week, it's Blue Beetle, and I refuse to learn who that is in advance of the film. I spoke to the team behind the Edinburgh Film Festival about bringing back the festival in 2023, and we're reviewing Oliver Payton's Lie to Me. And for Film Club, we'll be watching Maurice. Thanks very much for tuning in, and if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, Leila Latif, and my guests this week were Charles Bromesco and Anna Bogatskaya. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Bob Stankus.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.